This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
It won't be!
BFM 89.9, you are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Sharmila and Arvin, and it's Thursday, which means that it is our supercut. A couple of things to make clear at the outset. We are not actually live in studio this week because of reasons for leave clearing, basically, to be entirely honest. However, we do have what I hope is a fun show lined up for you, so do stick around. And please feel free to send us your thoughts anyway. We will continue to read them. They just won't make it on air. But you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, the topic today is Squid Game, but not, right? Because what we wanted to explore is what happens when a specific culture is displayed on screen and gets taken up really enthusiastically by the whole world. And then the people who are actually part of the culture go, I don't know. I'm not so sure. And this is based on a Vanity Fair article that basically explored the fact that South Koreans have very complicated feelings about Squid Game.
I think the whole Squid Game popularity came in these sort of weird waves, right? Because first there was the show itself, then there was the memes, then there was the sort of growing worldwide recognition. And along with that recognition, I think came the pushback from people in South Korea for a number of reasons. I think some of it had to do with the fact that they realized a lot of people were consuming this game on a very different level, and that they were losing the nuances and losing the actual social, cultural connections that the show was making. And I do think that that's a valid concern. I mean, I don't claim to know a lot about South Korean day-to-day realities, but I could pick up on the fact that a lot of the show references some deep-rooted problems in Korea. But it's also entirely possible for you to watch it and not really see any of that, or just take it in as a Hunger Games-type dystopian setting. And I think you lose a lot by that.
I also think it's super interesting that most of the people who are dissecting Squid Game or the social context that's being picked apart in these like Korean films, stuff like Parasite, stuff like Burning, even Train to Busan has a lot of social context in it. Most of the people picking it apart are not Korean at all. Like, it's coming from a completely different market halfway across the planet, right? And it makes sense that a lot of things would get lost in translation. And it's also interesting that Squid Game, it took Squid Game to be like the cherry on top for us to be doing this. It's such a 2021 thing. It's such a 2021 show. It's such a 2021 discussion, because I don't think culture on screen was a big thing that people were talking about. Even like, what, 15, 20 years ago, it used to be very problematic without the actual effort to show culture on screen.
So that's the weird thing, right? That's usually the complaint. But what I found interesting about the article was that the call is coming from inside the house, right? It's actually people in South Korea who are saying, hey, I don't... There was the issue of violence. There are all the issues of like the stuff that we covered, right? Language, translation. But what I've personally found interesting is the convention and the fact that, for example, the melodramatic scenes that they talked about and the characteristic that is typical of K-dramas, shinpa, this idea of trying to evoke emotion. And you have Korean viewers going, this is basic, essentially, and you guys are being manipulated and you don't even know it. And I really find that fascinating because it speaks to how we consume international things and the way that we get used to it. It's all sorts of things. It's writing, it's acting styles, it's like all the different things that make up a personification of a different culture on screen.
So it reminds me of how annoyed I get when Hollywood tries to do Bollywood and how it so often fails just because they just don't get the fact that some things are actually very basic, some things are actually very common. And it's like they take the most superficial elements of what makes your classic Bollywood, you know, huge, colorful drama interesting, and then think that that's all it takes. So if you look at something like Pride and Prejudice, so even something like Mistress of Spices, which doesn't go the musical route, but is still kind of wrapped up in this weird Eastern mysticism, they all just feel really flat and weird. It's as if they took a photo of a Bollywood film and thought they could make a film around it and that it would work. And it clearly doesn't.
It's also, I don't know how much it also goes to the actors who are in these movies. So a lot of times, like when a movie becomes, or like a TV show becomes super famous, you see interviews done in Hollywood, like on the red carpet and stuff. And they get asked questions like, how does it feel to be famous now? You know, how does it feel to leave the house? How does it feel to have so many fans? And you're like, this is one of the biggest names in that industry. So they've had this issue, quote unquote, for a long, long time. But that level of ignorance is something that's always there, right? Like when a thing becomes famous in Hollywood or in the US, they feel like that's the time when it's become like a big cultural boom and when everybody's paying attention, when that's actually not the case. Like people have known for a long time. It's just now famous on a mainstream level or like a Hollywood level, I guess.
So the Hollywoodization is interesting because I think that a part of why it's appealing actually, or why suddenly people flock to it and then people in the country or in the original culture go, I really don't get this, is because Hollywood makes things pretty. It makes things clean and neat and easy to consume, and I don't have to go do a Google. The subtitles will do the heavy lifting for me, or preferably people speak accented English, better yet. You know, and so I think that there is a certain level of appeal of watching how Hollywood translates a specific culture as opposed to watching something that originated from the country itself and was only ever meant for the people really within it, and anyone else is a bonus.
And Hollywood is often stuck in that weird space of needing to both appeal to the fans of the whatever original trope they're trying to clone, and also to an audience that is largely very unfamiliar, the American audience. I mean, American audience don't even like reading subtitles, let alone trying to understand that people may act differently in a different culture, or that things may literally look different on screen, or even something like Mulan and Wuxia, that what you're sort of getting is a very, very sanitized and simplified version of the original.
Which is why I'm always worried that when films become famous in Hollywood, or like, you know, they get like Oscar noms and stuff, that a certain industry is going to try to buckle to Hollywood standards. Because, you know, once you taste that success, then it's not easy to ignore that stuff, right? And I'm always worried, like, especially with Korean cinema and stuff, that they're going to try to cater to, you know, that more Hollywoodized sentiments or that more mainstream sentiment. And then you sort of lose out on the cultural aspects that made those films famous in the first place. Stuff like Parasite. I can't imagine like a sanitized Parasite, especially with the remake and stuff. It just sounds off.
So we're talking today about the way that culture is displayed, or the way that culture is worked through on screen, and how sometimes that just really doesn't work out, and how this is kind of a perennial problem on screen. This is happening partly because Squid Game was such a huge deal, and then people in South Korea didn't seem to feel the same way, so we thought it was a good time to explore. Let us know, though. I mean, how do you feel about watching your culture, whatever that may be, displayed on screen? What are some good examples? What are some bad examples? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, I think that our next clip is actually a really strong example of how you need to have a lot of context, actually, in order to appreciate the film in full.
Yes, because if you, we are going to be playing Get Out. Sorry for ruining the surprise. But I think if you watch Get Out in isolation and don't understand the path that horror has taken to the screen, the path that Black characters have taken to the screen, the role Black characters often play in these kinds of movies, You need to know that to understand why Get Out is such a clever film. So I think it does really depend on culture in a very specific way.
Also, Jordan Peele has like blatantly said that the messages and the themes in the movie are meant for an African-American audience and not for anyone else. So like literally he's openly said that if you don't get it and you're not from the black community or you're not black, then like he doesn't care. Like the movie isn't made for you. So that's the other thing. That's the other like subcontext in that film.
So here is a little bit of Get Out.
Tell me when you found it. Come here, Chris, look at me.
Found it.
You're so scared. You think it was your fault? How do you feel now?
I can't move.
You can't move.
Why can't I move?
You're paralyzed.
Just like that day when you did nothing. You did nothing.
Now, sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
Aja aja jinde shami nane ke tal ja zari wale neele aasmane ke tal.
BFM 89.9, did you feel like you were in a party in 2010 for a second? Because there was a moment in time where that song was so fundamentally inescapable. We are today, well, we, meaning Lynn, Sharmila and Arvind today, are talking about culture on screen for our supercut. And we played that, of course, because for a time, I mean, Slumdog Millionaire was the movie. It was a huge, huge deal.
Did anyone else think it was super weird that a film about the slums of India, disempowered, disadvantaged children, then had a song that the Pussycat Dolls made a cover of? Like, looking back, I'm just like, how did this happen? How was this okay?
Those are crazy times.
Such a weird time. But, you know, rewatching that song for the purposes of this show made me realize that that song is really the highlights reel of that film, because it has all the parts that are probably the things people remember, those great heady scenes of the children running through the city in India, and just the verve of watching these kids who were really children from these communities. But it also gets me thinking about how when you tell these kinds of stories, particularly as a person who's not from there, it adds this weird layer of complexity, which, again, I think the 10 years is an important thing to talk about, because I don't know if a Slumdog Millionaire could be made today and sort of not get heavily criticized.
So I think if this was like the 10th famous film to come out of India, let's say, or like Indian cinema, then I don't think it would have been as heavy, or I don't think it would have been as heavily criticized. But I think because Slumdog was like the first big blockbuster to come out and do all the Oscar rounds and stuff, and sort of quote-unquote represent a certain part of Indian culture, that I don't know, something about it was like, is this the first way to make a big impression and for it to be a story like this? Because I liked the movie when it came out, but I kind of understood the impact on culture that these movies have when the word slumdog was the new term for like an Appu or that people would use to make jokes. And then I'm like, oh, okay, so that's what's happening, which isn't nice, right? And they use that movie to sort of represent an entire country and diverse cultures in a massive, massive population, all boiled down to basically a slumdog or the quote-unquote
boiled down. Yeah. I see what you did.
So, like, you know, just to represented by, quote-unquote, the slumdog. So, I don't know. I was always kind of uncomfortable with the film. Appreciated it. Don't know if I liked it even the first time.
I don't know if I can separate Slumdog Millionaire from the hype. Because when I watched it, it was a movie that I was already aware of. You know, it's not something that I came into fresh. It's like, oh, what is this? Let me just buy a ticket. It wasn't like that. By the time it arrived here, I remember being very swept up in the jai-ho-ness of it all and everybody just being really, really into the film and all these true life stories kind of emanating from it and making the film more than it was. I do think two things. I do think it's very, very tricky when one of the more famous movies about a country is representing poverty. I think that that generally is a tough line to walk. You see it happen with African films a lot. You see it, I was thinking of City of God, City of God, and how it makes you think about the favelas in Brazil. And, you know, it's an important story to tell, but when it's the most, one of the most famous stories, I think it colors the country in a certain way. The other thing that I find tricky about India and Indian cinema in particular is because the industry there is so large, pervasive and strong, it's always very weird when Hollywood comes in and makes movies about India. I always find it to be odd because I'm like, I don't know what exactly this is doing. I feel the same way about, yeah, any of the other really big Asian cinematic industries. Whenever Hollywood comes in and goes, I'm making a South Korean movie now, I'm like, I don't know about this.
What I can't separate from is from when it comes to thinking about Slumdog Millionaire is actually the weird sense of recognition and affirmation so many Indians felt when the movie came out. And I hate that. I hate that, but I also understand that because every time Hollywood deigns to make a movie that's about Indian culture, we collectively as a community somehow suddenly feel like, oh my God, I'm seeing myself on screen. And because of that, there's this great sense of excitement. It's sort of waning a little bit now, I think, particularly because we have streaming services that constantly put out so much content. Some of these Indian-made shows and movies are actually doing better than Hollywood stuff. But still, I think, you know, seeing Kumail Nanjiani in The Eternals was a big deal. The same way seeing Simu Liu in Shang-Chi is a big deal. And it shouldn't have to be. But I remember how when Slumdog came out, my entire family watched it and were proud. And I don't want to discount what that feels like. But I also feel that that leaves me feeling kind of angry and weird because is this really the only thing we have to be proud of?
I also think it goes to effort. And like I always ask myself, like how much effort was put into like making this project or movie or making it accurate to the people it's trying to represent, right? So in that sense, I think if Slumdog is a slice of life story that's supposed to tell the tale of just a particular group of people, then there is a certain amount of effort as opposed to something like Life of Pi, which is a nice movie. And I enjoyed that a lot more than Slumdog, but anyone who speaks Tamil will know that the language spoken in Life of Pi is forced and artificial and it's just not natural. No one speaks like that. So to me, that shows a lack of effort because it would have been very easy to consult someone who didn't speak Tamil to come on set and go like, look, does this sound natural to you? And for that person to go, no, you know, this isn't. Or to hire people who actually spoke the language in the first place. So for especially that is coming from Ang Lee, who is an Asian director. So for a crew like that to go in and then make a movie that is not accurate to the language is also like a whole other level of something. Like, you know, I'm like, now this is like this is rubbing me the wrong way because it could have been easily remedied if they tried, you know.
I have so much to say about that, but I will tee it up for the second half of our show. I do think, though, this comes down to who was this made for? And I think that we are sensitive to that. We meaning everyone, actually. Everyone who isn't necessarily mainstream Hollywood American consumer, you are going to be sensitive to, wait, did you make this for me or did you make it for those other guys over there? So we can talk about that in a little bit. However, I did think that we should spend a bit of time setting up our next clip because it is a show that we all really love. And I think it's also an important part of when we talk about culture on screen, immigrant stories, whether first generation, second generation immigrant stories, are such a huge element of that. And Kim's Convenience, at least in its earlier seasons, was a beautiful example.
I love Kim's Convenience because despite the overt South Korean-ness of the people, they also don't seem like caricatures. They have such real family dynamics. I love the way each of them have such developed personalities. And the stories they tell often have very little to do with Korean-ness. And I think that's an important part of acknowledging that people aren't just the cultures that they represent, that people are people. And Kim's Convenience, until maybe the last season, did such a great job of doing that.
Oh, that's interesting. Because to me, they look like stereotypes. And I've always felt like they come off as stereotypes with accents and the way they carry themselves and stuff. But it just goes back to the story. I always feel like because the story is so earnest and honest and they take time to tell those stories, that it doesn't matter at the end of the day. That it's, you know, it's meant to be a sitcom. And as a sitcom, it works just fine.
So we are talking today about culture on screen and the very tricky ways and the tricky, I guess, reactions that it gets in terms of how it's translated, right? And we'd like to hear from you. Basically, how do you feel when you watch your own culture on screen? What are some examples you think that have done it well? What are some that haven't? WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back. Here's a little bit of Kim's.
Hi, Jenna.
Wow, Mr. Kim, that's quite the get up.
See. Si. Me and my señorita, Mrs. Akimi, need to go to costume party.
Appa, what are you doing?
I'm a Mexican burrito.
Think you mean bandito.
Yeah, same, same.
Appa, you can't dress like that. It's cultural appropriation.
Oh. Hi, guys. Just on my way to B Street, then going to our cottage in the Muskoka.
Oh, so Oma can dress like this, but I can't dress like a Mexican bandit?
How would you feel if someone from Mexico dressed in a plaid shirt and started saying, me from Korea, me run convenience store?
I'd be proud. And I not talk like that.
Oh, that reminds me, Janet. Where's my hanbok? I can't find.
It was a big hit at the Halloween party.
You take my Korean dress for Halloween?
That's a cultural appropriation, Janet.
No, that's different. I'm Korean.
You were born in Canada. Janet, our culture is not costume.
Ugh, that's rich coming from a Korean guy dressed like a Mexican criminal.
Beyond Frivolous Matters. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
The next week, I brought Rich to Mom's birthday dinner, sort of a surprise present. I figured she was going to have to accept Rich, like it or not.
Of course, the night was still young. Thank God I already prepped him on the Emily Post of Chinese manners. Actually, there were a few things I forgot to mention.
Let me make a toast.
He shouldn't have had that second glass when everyone else had had only half an inch just for taste.
Shrimp. My favorite.
He should have taken only a small spoonful of the best dish until everyone had had a helping.
He has good appetite.
But the worst was when Rich criticized my mother's cooking, and he didn't even know what he had done. As is the Chinese cook's custom, my mother always insults her own cooking. But only with the dishes she serves with special pride.
This dish not salty enough. No flavor. It's too bad to eat, but...
That was our cue to eat some and proclaim it the best she'd ever made.
You know, Linda, all this needs is a little soy sauce.
BFM 89.9. I'm still recovering a little bit from the sting of that clip. You are listening to Popcorn Culture Supercut with Lynn, Sharmilan, Arvin. And today we are talking about culture on screen and how it's quite a tricky proposition getting it right. Now, we have been asking you, what are some examples you think of when it's been done well, right? Your own culture being displayed on screen in a way that works. What are some examples that have not been so fantastic? Please send them our way. Full disclosure, we are not actually in studio because we are clearing leave. Sorry, it is year end. But we still read everything that's sent. So WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Write to us at movies@bfm.my. And yeah, I mean, I think we do need to talk a little bit more about immigrant experiences or something American experiences. In other words, Indian American experiences, Chinese American, Asian American, you know, and just all the ways in which that is sometimes so familiar and also so incredibly alien.
So for a time, Joy Luck Club came out in 1993. I think for such a significant part of my childhood, I rewatched it over and over and over. And I had so much love for the movie because it literally was the first time I had watched Asian-ness. I'm not even Chinese, but Asian-ness represented on screen in a way that felt real. So because of that, I have a lot of love for that film. And it still feels so relevant, right? So much of the stuff that they portray in Joy Luck Club still feels relevant. And I think it's because that idea of being transposed, sometimes stuck between two cultures, two worlds, is such a significant story. But it has also struck me as we become older and us being in places like Malaysia, that often the tendency to want to tell that story, the Asian American story, doesn't always sit very well with other kinds of immigrants. Never Have I Ever is one of the most recent examples I can think of where I felt like their idea of being immigrants is so wrapped up in the idea of Americanness that it only seems to appeal to people who themselves share that. And for Indians who are perhaps migrants in other places, it feels almost as alien as watching a different culture.
I'm also wondering how much gets lost even within that Asian-American experience between people who speak two different languages. So I'm thinking about this conversation that we had off-air about Shang-Chi and how the subtitling didn't represent what was being said in the movie in Mandarin, right? So if you don't understand the language and you're reading the subtitles, then you lose out on a lot of power and a lot of meaning in those words and in the dialogue that's being said. So that was just something that I was thinking about, even within that context of Asian American, how much doesn't translate in the same community, you know?
So I rewatched Shang-Chi recently. Great experience. Really enjoyed it. Still again. Noticed more about the subs. So many are wrong. Because I don't speak...
Oh no, I feel so cheated.
I don't speak Mandarin that well, really. But the second round, I watched it with my father, who does and who in fact reads. And he was just like, that's literally not the phrase. And so the meaning is there, but there are literal phrases that are completely different. I do think, though, that is one of those... when it comes to language... it's so tricky, right? Because it also comes down to nuance and behavior. Language isn't just about what is said. Sometimes it's about the phraseology. Sometimes it's about what you don't say, the jokes that are used. And I think that is also another way in which some things, we talked about this before, simply do not translate. Or you're going to have to do additional work if you're watching a show that is set in another culture, because you need to understand, when she went silent, was she mad or was she happy? And depending on where you are in the world, they could be very different.
I remember being really puzzled and halfway mad when I watched Lagan with the international subtitles that it went out with. Because I was thinking, here's a film that's being marketed, you know, as an Oscar nominee. And then when you watch it, the subtitles in some parts are terrible. And then they're, especially for the songs, things that are hugely metaphorical and often say something about a person or the kind of character they are, end up sounding just so flat. And I think to a large extent, there's no getting around that. But on the other hand, it just really grates, because I'm like, what is an audience that has no awareness of this context getting from this? And they're probably understanding it all wrong.
Which is why I always find it problematic when people who are speaking a different language or have a certain kind of an accent speak in American dialogue or use words that would be primarily used by someone who's purely American or white American. I can't think of any examples, but even going back to Kim's Convenience, there were a few instances, and I know that's Canadian, but there were a few instances where the jokes came from someone who wouldn't be able to apply that language to the joke and wouldn't be able to apply that nuance to the joke or the humor that they were trying to pull off. So for me, that was a bit like... it was weird. It was weird seeing someone who wouldn't naturally do that say something in that way or use words that wouldn't come naturally to them. I can't think of any specific other examples at the moment.
I even feel that way about a Gal Gadot sometimes because of her, her Israeli accent. I mean, she looks quote unquote Western, but her accent and her delivery sometimes, or Aishwarya Rai, you know, these people, they just don't have the cadence to pull off a particularly very American line, but then it's given to them anyway. And it sounds really weird when they say it.
Salma Hayek. Same thing. Yeah.
Now we're just naming people with accents. But I mean, I do hear that. I think that that comes down to what you find believable. And so I think for people who live in countries where these languages are spoken, or where multiple languages are spoken, you're like, you know what's believable? People speaking in different languages and roughly understanding, or doing what we do in Malaysia and like manglishing the heck out of it and hoping for the best, right? Like just peppering stuff in. But I suppose in primarily English-speaking countries, the expectation is an accent is fine as long as you're speaking English. That is what is normal.
And English like us.
And so I think that that is likely what it is that we are chafing against, which I totally get. I think, however, I wanted to talk about language in the context of Black films or Black shows, because that actually is an entire different category. When we talk about Hollywood, when we talk about American entertainment, for example, I don't actually think that we are, or perhaps not many of us, are thinking about shows like Insecure, even though they are also coming out from essentially Los Angeles. But they look, sound, behave, are paced completely differently.
So I did not expect this about Insecure, because I love that show so much. And I blazed through, I think, the first two seasons when I first discovered it. And I started recommending it to all and sundry, right? At least 50% of the people I recommended it to, and most of them are Malaysian, came back saying, not that they didn't find it funny, but that they found it difficult to follow, that they found it difficult to understand, that the humor didn't quite land. And I started thinking about why this might be so, and I realized it's because Insecure speaks, or people in Insecure speak in what I presume is Black vernacular, the way they would speak between themselves, and not the way they might speak or code switch when they speak to people outside. And that's very interesting, because largely when you watch Hollywood films or Hollywood TV shows, even if they feature Black characters, they tend to be speaking in a sort of much more flat accent. Even if they sound recognizably African-American, they don't sound the way they do in Insecure.
You know what's weird, though, is that Insecure, to me, Insecure is one of the toned-down shows when it comes to Blackness in TV shows or in movies. And I don't know if I'm phrasing it the right way or not, but it seems like something that's more accessible to a mainstream audience as opposed to something that would be primarily directed and made for a Black audience.
So I hear you, but I think that what it is there is with Insecure, there are little lived-in moments. You have to know what a wind down is or what a block party is in order to get some actually pretty large plot points within the show. And so I think that, Shyamala, what you said earlier is key, which is this idea that it's how people speak to each other and not how Denzel Washington might speak to Ethan Hawke, for example. You know, it's just a completely different sort of experience. And so because of that, I think sometimes that the rest of the world consumes Black culture in a certain way. So we only recognize it when it's packaged in like Bad Boys. We only recognize it when it's packaged in. I keep coming back to Will Smith. I don't know why. But and that's what we know, and that's what we think of.
I kept thinking Will Smith too.
Yeah. And maybe because he's been the most famous sort of headliner over the last 20 years at this point. But I think that with Insecure, instead, it's smaller moments. And so people maybe don't know what to do with that. I have to say, I didn't notice the language. Part of it being that, I mean, if you're watching some Valley Girl thing, half the time you don't understand what they're saying anyway, but you get it through context.
So I think it's a number of things. I think it's actually the unfamiliarity of so much of what we see on screen. And I don't mean that as a bad thing, because I perceive that as freshness. But for a lot of people, it's multiple layers of needing to recognize something, even something as simple as the title of the episodes, the fact that they use things like low-key something, or what was the other one? The AF repetition. You need to know what that means in a certain way. And I just think that when people of cultures that are not that mainstream white want to tell these sorts of personal everyday stories, Insecure is a good example that they actually have to cross so many more hurdles than the average white creator might have to.
there's a whole conversation about those words and languages leaving that culture and being like mainstreamed and used as memes and stuff. But I wanted to ask you guys, like, so in the context of what we are talking about today, right, what do you think about Black Panther? Because I know that everyone says like it's amazing and it's the movie for like, you know, representing a culture and stuff. But it's actually not representing any culture because it's a fictional country. Like Wakanda doesn't exist. The people don't exist. But it's doing a lot for the African-American population. It's doing a lot for the African population in terms of like representing a culture to the mainstream audience. So how does that work in terms of putting culture on screen when it's not actually putting any culture on screen?
I think the power of Black Panther is actually precisely that it doesn't tie itself to, it does address the African-American experience, but the fact that it actually creates this, it's called Afrofuturism, right? And this notion of a positive, a positive non-white culture that's managed to become so superlative. I think that's why it was empowering not just to Black people, but to all non-white people everywhere. And I think there's something quite special about that. And I think that's why something like Black Panther resonates even more, I'd argue, than something like Shang-Chi, because it imagines a future or a possibility that we haven't seen yet.
I've never been moved by Black Panther in that regard. I have to say, I like it as a film very much. But I think that for me, where my heart sings when it comes to cultural representation is specificity. And so with Black Panther, because it went the Pan-African route, which is great, and I really enjoyed it, I ended up treating it more like a sci-fi. You know, I recognize and respect the emotional resonance that it has for people, but it did not have the same for me in the same way that Raya and the Last Dragon did not, because that's Pan-Southeast Asian. It's just all cultures. No cultures, you know. There is a durian. Malaysians can feel very happy about that, but it's not. There's nothing specific to us. It borrows from the Thais. It borrows from the Vietnamese. It borrows from the Indonesians, and so you get representation, yes, but it's hugely non-specific. And I wonder also whether that is just how we can expect large companies and large studios to do it, because really they want as many people as possible to watch their films. And so if it comes down to a Disney, this is probably how they're going to do it. And then the smaller, more specific stories will come out on VOD now that they have that platform.
Yeah, but I think there's also value in having both, to be honest. And I completely understand what you mean. Specificity is really great. I think, though, that you're right, that even I perceive Black Panther not as a story of today, but almost like a sci-fi or a fantasy film.
And it's also like an amazing first step because it opened a lot of doors. That movie opened so many, many doors.
So we're talking today about culture on screen and how tricky it can be to get it right. We'd like to hear from you. We're not here. We're here, but we're not here. We will be here reading. We're not currently here live on air. But yes, please send. While we're talking about sci-fi, might as well go all the way. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Here's a little bit of Insecure.
My credit score can't be that bad. Bad would be a step up. The basic credit tiers are excellent, good, poor, bad. This is easy. It's all the way at the bottom. Well, unless you get a cosigner, not me. Or you could put down 3 or 4 months rent if you've been saving.
Ooh, I have been saving.
Okay.
I've been saving. No, you know I eat out a lot.
Oh, girl.
Lids? I like my caps fitted.
That is just... Radio Shack ain't even a store no more. Rite Aid. You buying groceries at Rite Aid?
I buy panties there, too.
Well, if it'll make you feel better, then you could throw them a few extra bucks.
Oh, yeah. You're not charging me the stuff.
I'm sorry, what?
You're not charging me the stuff.
You not? You can't keep buying it.
What?
Kelly?
No.
Not even a little bit.
Kelly.
Okay. You cooking? Cleaning. Detailing the nigga's car. Damn, you're getting over. I mean, if Daniel let you stay a little longer, you should, just to save money. Don't look a gift horse in a...
That's not a thing.
It is. My grandmother said it to me.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Well, he proposed to me yesterday. He said he'd walk away from his family and from you for good. Don't worry, I turned him down.
Only a fool folds a winning hand.
There's no winning. You made sure of that. Because if Nick chose me, he would lose his family. And if he chose his family, he might spend the rest of his life resenting you.
So you chose for him?
I'm not leaving because I'm scared. Or because I think I'm not enough. Because maybe for the first time in my life, I know I am. I just love Nick so much. I don't want him to lose his mom again. So I just wanted you to know that one day, when he marries another lucky girl who is enough for you, and you're playing with your grandkids while the tanhuas are blooming and the birds are chirping, that it was because of me, a poor, raised by a single mother, low-class immigrant, nobody.
BFM 89.9, I've always wanted to come in on like a swell like that. It just feels so dramatic. You're listening to Popcorn Culture's Supercut, where today we're focused on culture on screen and how tricky it can be to nail it. And for who? Which community? If you'd like to weigh in, send us your thoughts. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. That was, of course, Crazy Rich Asians. And I mean, like, I think as far as representation goes, it's hard to talk about how it's been in the last, I don't know, 5 years without mentioning that film.
I don't want to be this person.
Be it. Do it.
I've been the person before. I really didn't like Crazy Rich Asians. I like it as a dumb rom-com. I enjoyed it. And I see the value of there being dumb rom-coms that feature Asian people. But you know that thing you said earlier about specificity? I think Crazy Rich Asians is a great example of specificity gone wrong. Because it takes this sort of weird, hyper-focused lens of a particular kind of Southeast Asian / Singaporean / community-driven people. And it claims to be representing Asians. And, you know, in America, everyone is celebrating it as being such great representation. I didn't feel represented by the film at all. And I don't think that it really did anything other than put people who look like us in this region.
I watched it in my mansion, dripping in my diamonds, and I felt great.
I'm sorry.
My auntie, Michelle Yeoh, was great. And I loved it. I mean, like, I was playing with my mahjong mate with Jade. Loved it.
I mean, it might be because my uncle was a security guard outside that mansion in the film.
Singapore's problem, not ours. This is what I like to say.
Do you think Singapore likes the way this movie showed them or not? Because part of me thinks, like, you know, the exorbitantness and the abundance in the film, that Singapore would be like, yeah, that's us. You know, that's 100% accurate, without calling them out and all the false facts or whatever is in the film. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Crazy Rich Asians. It was kind of like neutral because exactly because of what you said, I don't think the movie is trying to represent anyone. You can swap it for a different country, a different people. All they have to be is rich. Like, they have to be like filthy rich people.
And crazy.
and crazy. And you get the exact same story. So in that context, I don't know if it's actually doing anything to represent a culture or just using tropes and certain stereotypes from Singapore or quote-unquote Malaysia that shows up in the film.
So I will say that I enjoyed the film, but not because of anything to do with representation, but particularly because I recognized early on that it was going to be a smart, slick rom-com and that therefore I could just switch my brain off and watch them like traipse around the Malayans. And I'm like, fine, just take them, you know? And so I was okay with that from that point of view. I think that it's a good rom-com. It does all the things that a rom-com is supposed to do. However, when it comes to this idea of cultural representation, we now come to something I've been wanting to talk about, which is two things. One is acting style and the other is actor choice. And I bring this up particularly because Michelle Yeoh, yes, is from our region, so fine. But you have Ken Jeong, who's pretending to be a Singaporean mogul. You have Awkwafina. You have people who are clearly, you know, not from here and putting on accents in order to be from here. And then it gets a little bit complicated when we say this is so great for representation. But then I also wonder whether there is something, whether acting styles always translate. And I don't believe that they do. And I don't believe that every actor, in fact, wants to make that translation. So I think here we come into this weird territory of when we say Asians on screen, when we say, you know, any other, choose a country on screen, who are the actors that we're talking about and what is the acting style that we want to see?
And doesn't that go back to that question of who is this film for? Mm. Because this film was clearly for an American audience who wouldn't be able to tell the difference, largely wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a Southeast Asian Chinese person, a China Chinese person, a Hong Kong Chinese person, or an American Chinese person. Because in this film, you're all interchangeable. But if the film was intended for Southeast Asia and actual Singaporean or Malaysian audiences, we would immediately know that Ken Jeong or Awkwafina could not pass for a Singaporean-born, raised person. And I think that when we talk about authenticity or representation, you don't necessarily have to do that. I'm not sure I subscribe so heavily to questions of things like Rami Malek shouldn't play Freddie Mercury because he's not Parsi. Because I think in some cases, it's fine to make those kinds of choices based on talent and look and so on. But when it comes to being able to embody a story, especially when you're claiming to represent something, I think that's where it gets tricky. And so often this mantle of representation, and we talked about this when we talked about Never Have I Ever as well, consciously using it in your marketing then places a certain lens through which you're then judged.
But do you get a pass? Like, or does Hollywood get a pass if they say it's meant for an American audience or like a Western audience? Because who, like, if they're making this movie to be mainstream, then do they have to cater to tiny Singapore and tiny Malaysia? Or do they have to cater to, like, you know, the everyone else in the world who's not going to know the difference, even if they tell you all these false facts or they are misrepresenting people, right? So I don't know, like, does it, part of me thinks it kind of does in a weird way. Another part of me thinks, like, because it's such a global force and it's such a global platform now, like Hollywood makes so much box office money from the global box office that they can't afford to use that as like a hall pass anymore. Like, you have to take the effort.
I think as, you know, someone who was raised on a pretty conventional media diet, for a long time, I just sort of accepted it. And you just go, OK, whatever, this is what it is. It's OK. But this idea of the marketing and of the marketing focusing on representation is actually a huge deal for me, because if you go out and the director is talking about how this is going to center narratives that have never been seen, and you have actors saying that, oh, I've always wanted to see myself on screen, like it very much puts a certain spin on the whole thing. And then you are telling me that I'm supposed to find it relatable. And so I think that there I find the onus being on me. I don't appreciate that. It's like, no, you didn't make this for me. And that's okay. I can enjoy it as a film, a la Crazy Rich Asians. I'm perfectly fine with it. But don't go and then tell me that this is going to combat Asian American hate. Like, I just don't think that drawing those kinds of comparisons are actively helpful or even relatable in any sense.
So I want to draw on what you said, Lynn, about acting styles or conventions and how much they can differ, right? Because I was thinking about how Shang-Chi used Tony Leung, who comes from a very different style. You know, the Hong Kong style of acting is not the Hollywood style of acting. And when you see him on screen juxtaposed against people like Simu Liu, you can tell. But the film is clever enough to accommodate that. It knows what it's doing when it uses someone like Tony Leung. And so it kind of shapes the film around him and his style. And when I watched him was when I realized why so many big Indian stars either can't break into the Hollywood market or just choose not to, because these films largely don't do that. They don't center the idea that, in fact, what they bring to the screen is different, not just that they're a new face or they're a big star back in their home countries, but that they bring something that needs to be, in a way, accounted for. And I think that argument can actually be extended to a lot of culture, that when you want to draw on specific aspects of culture to tell a story on screen, you need to actually think about how that fits into the story you're telling, rather than it's window dressing, we'll put it here, it'll work somehow.
If we flip that in terms of like the acting, the performances, the people and the culture itself, right? Is it valid to flip it when we talk about representation of white American culture on screen? And I know that this is a super tricky conversation because when you talk about culture, we're normally talking about people of color and people who have not been represented as much on the big screen or on TV shows, right? But I'm thinking about stuff like Nomadland that was directed by Chloe Zhao, who doesn't come from that background and is sort of learning as a third person or from a third person point of view, telling a 99.9% pro-American, pro-white story about a certain kind of culture and a certain kind of people. So it comes down to like the performances and the people she chooses and what she thinks that culture is supposed to be, as opposed to maybe what that culture is inherently. So I don't know if it's the same conversation or not. Like it should come down to the same thing, right? Because she hasn't lived that life, and she's coming in from a foreign quote-unquote culture to tell the story of a pro-American way of doing things.
I think there's a case to be made for, and this is going to sound like a neat statement, and I don't intend for it to be. I think there's a case to be made for minority experiences, a certain amount of it being able to understand someone else's lack of representation. So the people in Nomadland are people we never see represented in cinema. So in that sense, I think bringing Chloe Zhao's experience of being othered or not being seen to someone else's experience of being othered and not being seen, I think it'd actually be quite an interesting and effective way. The same way White Tiger as a film works so well, because the director, he is an Indian, but he is a director of color, and he's a director who's worked with these sorts of underrepresented stories before. And I think that they are able to translate those experiences somehow.
I think it comes down to what we're talking about in the story, right? Because I think that if we talk about the cultural aspects of Nomadland, aside from the nomadicism, it's also the call of the road. It's also this idea of how the American economy is doing, how it's sidelining people. And I think these are things that you could argue people in other countries can appreciate and can understand. But it's the stuff that perhaps you grow up with, you know, the cultural practices that I think are the ones that when we talk about culture and missing the mark, those are the ones that traditionally haven't met it, as opposed to the ones that are not narrative devices, but that are parts of the story more so than they are parts of the culture. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it from us, I think. We've been talking today about this idea of culture on screen and how doing justice to it can be a very hard thing. We'd like to hear from you. What are some examples of movies that have done it right, movies that have done it wrong? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, write to us at movies@bfm.my. You can also find us at BFM Popcorn on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. You've been listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.